Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
There's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, and tomorrow's just a dream away. Man has a dream, and that's the start. He follows his dream with mind and heart. And when it becomes a reality, it's a dream come true for you and me. So there's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. There's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow, just a dream away.
Well, it sounds pretty good. In fact, that's just the right spirit.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ink and Paint, a podcast journey through the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. We're exploring one by one the films in the official Disney animated canon and talking about their artistic, historical, and social context, where they come from, their impact, and how they sit with us now. In our previous episode, the Silver Age came to an end with the death of Walt Disney and the final animated film on which he was directly involved, the acclaimed and beloved classic, The Jungle Book. In this episode, we move on to the Bronze Age, the period of artistic unrest and rediscovery in the wake of Walt's death, and to the first film created without him, the Parisian feline adventure, The Aristocats. Each episode on Ink and Paint, I am joined by a special guest, not just film and animation enthusiasts, but people from all different professions. This week, I'm joined by veterinary nurse and director of Maneki Neko Cat Rescue, Joanne Amos. Established in 2012, Maneki Neko Cat Rescue is the largest non-for-profit cat rescue in Victoria, and are specifically focused on working collaboratively with the community, community groups, businesses, and local councils to reduce cat euthanasia rates, increase reclaiming rates, decrease surrender rates, and increase rehoming rates through the rescue, rehabilitation, and rehoming of cats and kittens, as well as the prevention of unwanted cats and kittens and support for owners faced with giving up their pets due to financial hardship or domestic violence. From small beginnings of just 4 volunteers in 2012, rescuing and rehoming around 30 cats and kittens, Maneki Neko Cat Rescue has grown to an organization of over 300 active volunteers, rescuing and rehoming 1,326 cats and kittens in 2020. Joe, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thanks, Daniel. It's very exciting to be here.
So to begin with, you've been working as a veterinary nurse for around 10 years now. What led you to decide on this as a career? What was your path to becoming a veterinary nurse?
From as early as I remember, I always wanted to work with animals. I grew up in a farming community. We always had lots of animals around, lots of pets. And I always just loved looking after them. We did a lot of our own medical side of things. And I knew that I always wanted to be either a vet or a vet nurse. And as I sort of got through schooling, I decided that no, nursing was for me. So it was kind of always something I knew I wanted to do and just continue to grow into it as I got older.
And what was the difference between being a vet and being a vet nurse that drew you to being a vet nurse? Because I don't think a lot of people don't think about the idea of animals needing a nurse. We think of the idea of humans needing a nurse, but we don't think about it with animals. Yet what led you to choosing vet nursing as opposed to being a vet?
Apart from not being quite smart enough.
I'm sure that's not true at all.
Nurses tend to be more practical, whereabouts vets tend to be more knowledgeable. They're more book learners, whereabouts nurses tend to be more practical on the job learners. And that was definitely my learning technique. And I sort of, knew late high school that while I sort of was studying to try and still be able to achieve veterinary if I wanted to, that probably was going to be a little bit unattainable, and that nursing was more my style anyway.
Was there a particular incident or a particular pet or anything, you know, when you were a kid or a teenager that made you start to think that this might be what it was you wanted to do?
Many, many pets. All of my baby photos have a cat on one side and a dog on the other side of me.
Oh, so you're neutral. You're not one or the other. You're a neutral person.
No. And I pretty much had every pet you could think of from a very young age. The answer was always yes, if I asked mum and dad, provided I was the one going to be looking after it. And we had farm animals as well. So, you know, I was out there helping deliver calves, hand-rearing lambs as soon as I could stand up and hold a bottle. And, you know, any kind of injuries or anything, like, would obviously see a vet, but the vets were 45-minute drive away. So a lot of the caring for the animals once they were injured and medicating and things like that I was doing. So it was very hands-on sort of education from a young age.
And I guess it exposes you to the kind of practical nature of life and death that comes with caring for animals, and I imagine comes with being a vet. My family live on a farm in Queensland as well, and I have exactly the same problem that the vet is 45 minutes away, and oftentimes my mum is just like, well, I guess I just have to work out how to do it myself. It's like, oh, I can't even imagine the pressure of that. After you'd completed, you know, veterinary nursing studies, what was the next path for you after that? After your studies, where did you end up going?
So veterinary nursing, you actually study while you are on the job. So it's done a little bit like a traineeship. So I did my precursor certificate two through TAFE, and then I got offered a job in Templestowe. So I walked in as a trainee and did my certificate four while working.
Which I imagine is a very useful and fruitful way of learning, because I mean, I imagine so much about the job of being a vet nurse is being able to have a relationship with the animals that you're working with for a very short space of time. How do you develop a relationship with an animal that you're working with, that you're taking care of?
Animals are all about body language. So they don't have, you know, obviously a verbal language like we do. So they rely on body language. And every animal's or every species is very different in the way that they do communicate. So it's all about learning how each different type of animal communicates and then picking up on those really subtle little signs that they might be giving you to show what they're feeling and what they think of the situation, and then also making sure that you adapt your own body language to be, you know, open and friendly and helping to build that trust with them, because you can't just walk in and have trust with an animal. They do require, you know, same with us really, require that sort of relationship to be built first. And it can be very hard for an animal when they come into an unknown environment that the clinic is, that can sound and smell and look scary, and have 15 minutes to sort of build that relationship with them that they will then trust you, you know, to be able to trim their nails or give them a tablet or hold them for the vet to do something mean, like, you know, pop a thermometer up the bottom or give them injections. So, you know, you...
All things that would be really great if you could explain to them, this is not a bad thing, but of course you can't explain that to them.
And not all animals are happy to sit there and just eat treats for the whole time either, so...
No. And then how did you come to working at Maneki Neko? How did cat rescue become part of your work?
So I had already done a little bit of cat rescue through my work. We had a litter of kittens handed in, less than 3 weeks of age, into the clinic one day. And at that age, they still need to be on their mother, but the person who found them didn't know where the mother was. So I took them home and was bottle rearing them. And then, you know, once they were sort of old enough, having to find them homes and things. And then I had a client who was fostering for another rescue organisation, and we were just sort of chatting about her work with, you know, what she was doing in regards to fostering, and she was doing a little bit more with them as well in regards to helping with fundraising and things. And she always used to say, I could do it better. And, you know, my response every time was, well, when you're ready to do it better, just let me know and I'm happy to help out. And we had a few of these conversations in the waiting room over time. And then one day she walked in and said, right, I'm doing it. Come round. We're going to have a meeting and let's do it. And so that was sort of how the idea of Maneki Neko was, yeah, formed, really.
And then how do you build a business like that? I mean, because, you know, it's I imagine there are certain, not just like financial challenges in terms and challenges in terms of resource, but also I imagine community challenges as well. How do you build a business like Maneki Neko?
Uphill battle some days. Samantha, who is our head director and who was the, you know, the brain trust of everything, did a lot of research in how to create and set up a non-for-profit organisation. Did a lot of research on what everyone else was doing, because it's always very important. You don't want to recreate the wheel if you can help it. So you look and see what everyone else is doing, what works, what doesn't work. And it was a lot of trial and error. Fundraising and financial aid is always the biggest thing. Anytime you're working in animal rescue, it's just a constant, you know, constantly working to find funds, because unfortunately we're very good at spending them.
Yes, cats in particular are very surprisingly financially demanding animals sometimes.
Yes, we also want to make sure that we're doing the right thing by these animals that we are rescuing. So every cat and kitten that come into care not only get desexed and vaccinated and microchipped, but any health issues they've got, whether it's something as basic as a cold or whether they need, you know, a dental procedure, or we've had a few that have needed major eye surgeries done at the eye specialist this month. And, you know, these are $2,500 surgeries after discounts. You know, a lot of the vets we work with are very kind and offer us discounts, but, you know, it's still a lot of money, and we want to make sure, you know, we're doing the right thing by these cats. So we're all about making sure that this work is done before we send them to their new homes, to make sure that they're, you know, starting off on the right paw in their new home too.
Because I imagine in most cases they haven't started off on the right paw at the beginning of their lives. Like, because I have a rescue cat. I bought him as a rescue kitten, and there's definitely a sense of, there are times with him that I go, oh, that's right, the first few weeks of your life were not great before somebody found you and rescued you and took care of you before it got to me. And there are different moments where you kind of go, oh yeah, they can have a very rough beginning of a life, and they grow so quickly and respond to things so quickly.
And the bulk of our cats and kittens have come through pounds and shelters. So they've done at least 8 days in a cage, you know, and there's a range of reasons why they've ended up at this cage at the shelter, whether they've been surrendered, whether they've been trapped off the streets and handed in. And, you know, being in a cage in a strange environment with a bunch of other cats is very stressful for cats. I don't know if you know this, but this portion of their brain that feels, experiences emotions is this as active as the same portion of our brain.
I did not know that.
They can actually experience just as many emotions as we can. They might not necessarily be the same emotions, but we always say cats are highly emotional animals. This is why their brain is actually developed that way. So
that's incredible.
Yeah. And so they do, you know, develop a lot of trauma while they're in these pounds and shelters. It's also, unfortunately, while the pounds and shelters do their best, it's a breeding ground for disease, having all these cats from different environments coming together in small spaces. So they do tend to become unwell while they're either in the pound shelter or just as they come out. So it's not a great start for the poor little things. And then we've got to somehow try and patch them up, both their mental and physical health. So,
well, I have a lot more questions about the work that you do with cats, but they all pertain to the film we're going to talk about. So I'll just digress for a moment to talk about another subject, which is your relationship with Disney animated films. So do you remember what the very first Disney animated film was that you saw?
I was introduced to Disney at such a young age that I do not have a memory of seeing the first film. We always had a very large VHS collection of Disney movies. Fantasia, Bambi, Pinocchio. I know those were sort of all the early ones that we had. But as new movies were coming out on tape, my mum was buying them. And I think we went and saw Sleeping Beauty at the cinema. And
you didn't? Really?
I don't remember it very well. I was having this conversation with my mum on the weekend going, what did we have? And, yeah, I don't remember going and seeing it, but I remember that Sleeping Beauty was always a very big part. Like, I always had that fondness for it, and I think that's because it was probably the first movie I saw at the cinema.
Oh, what a first film to see. That is, Sleeping Beauty is one of my absolute favourites, but I've never seen it in a cinema. And it's like, because when I was a kid, you know, the reruns were happening at cinemas, so it was quite easy to see them, but Sleeping Beauty just never turned up. So I'm palpably jealous that you've seen, even at a young age that you can't remember, you even seen it. What were the ones that you were drawn to as a kid when you were, you know, pulling the VHS tapes off the shelf and popping them in the TV? What were the ones that you were generally drawn to?
Anything with animals in it, definitely big ones. So the Aristocats and Bambi. Robin Hood got a pretty decent workout when we came along. But I loved like Aladdin and The Little Mermaid and those sort of ones as well.
And how's your relationship with Disney changed or grown or diminished as you've grown older? Has your love of Disney persisted?
It definitely has. I was very lucky in that I had a my brother arrived 10 years after me. So I was able to then share Disney with him and sort of, you know, continue watching Disney, where a lot of my friends were like, oh, Disney, you know, as you get through those teenage years, they try and pretend it's not cool. But I was like, you know, oh, I'm watching it with my brother, you know. And then even as my, like my adult years, we have a decent Disney collection still. And, you know, it's always been one of those sort of things to go back to when you need something feel good or just something you just want to watch where you don't have to think too much and you just get back into the flow and have a bit of a sing-along. And I actually watched Disney movies. I recently had my first child and we were watching Disney movies the whole time I was in labor to help.
Oh, my, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I have so many questions about this. I have to ask, what were you watching while you were in labor?
Well, I gave birth to my son while watching Bambi.
Oh, my God. I can't cope with that. It's so amazing. On December 16th, 1966, the day after the death of Walt Disney, his brother and president of Walt Disney Productions, Roy Disney, issued a statement. Written by Marty Sklar, the statement acknowledged the enormous loss of Walt, both to the Disney family and those who worked with him, and assured the staff at Disney that the future of the company was in safe hands. As president and chairman of the board of Walt Disney Productions, the statement read, "I want to assure the public, our stockholders, and each of our more than 4,000 employees that we will continue to operate Walt Disney's company in the way he has established and guided it." In truth, Roy wasn't entirely sure how. Walt had been such an indelible force in the company, not just in his leadership, but in his inventiveness and imagination. Many of his schemes, such as the yet-to-be-completed Disney World in Florida and the accompanying futuristic city of Epcot, were astoundingly ambitious. Feature animation, the foundation on which the company had been built after the phenomenal success of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in 1937, and their bustling slate of live-action films, had benefited from his innate understanding of storytelling, even when he expressed ambivalence towards them. Without Walt, Roy was unsure whether these intricate and costly departments could still function. Roy had initially decided to close the feature animation department, confident that the 19 films they had in their catalogue would bring in enough revenue through revival screenings. The enormous critical and commercial success of The Jungle Book, though, was perhaps enough to convince him that there was still a future in feature animation. The task of leading the department had fallen to animation director Wolfgang Reitherman, a member of Walt's Nine Old Men, who had directed the last two films and won the trust and respect of the animation staff. In the aftermath of Walt's death and the success of The Jungle Book, Reitherman rallied the team together to get a new feature film started. The problem was, Walt had only left one project in development before his death, and one that still needed a significant amount of work. The story of a family of cats living in Paris, and their journey back to home and safety. In Paris in 1910, a cat named Duchess and her three kittens, Marie, Berlioz and Toulouse, live a life of luxury with their affluent owner, Madame Adelaide Bonfamille. When Madame decides to leave her estate to Duchess and the kittens rather than her devoted manservant Edgar, the disgruntled butler decides to get rid of the cats, drugging them and leaving them in the French countryside. Determined to get home, Duchess and the kittens cross paths with a rogue tabby cat, Abraham de Lacy Giuseppe Casey Thomas O'Malley, who agrees to help them get back to Paris. After a series of adventures, during which Duchess and O'Malley grow affectionate towards each other, they finally return home, only to be once again kidnapped by Edgar. With the help of intrepid Mouse Roquefort and a team of alley cats, O'Malley rescues the family and sends Edgar in a trunk off to Timbuktu. Madame, relieved to have the kittens home, allows O'Malley to live with them, and he and Duchess settle down with the three kittens to form a new family together. The 20th Disney animated feature film, The Aristocats, was only the second to be developed from an original idea. Since its launch in 1954, the Disneyland television series had evolved past its purposes as a promotional tool for the theme park, being renamed Walt Disney Presents in 1958 and Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color in 1961, still hosted by Walt himself. On December 9, 1961, Walt asked director Tom McGowan and producer Harry Tytle to look into animal stories they could adapt as a two-part live-action special for the television series. By January the following year, McGowan had collected a number of possible contenders, but the one he was drawn to most was the story of a mother cat and her kittens living in New York. Working with Tytle, McGowan came up with a rough storyline, but Tytle suggested they follow 101 Dalmatians and set the story in an international location. They decided on Paris and came up with a story where a disgruntled butler and maid, frustrated that the mistress of the house plans to leave her money to her cats, decide to get rid of them. The treatment focused more on the humans than the cats themselves, with Boris Karloff and Francois Rosé considered to play the central pair. The cat subplot would involve the mother cat trying to find new homes for each of her kittens. Writer Tom Rowe was brought onto the project and a first draft of the script was completed in August 1962. But while it was initially rejected by a Disney executive, Walt gave the project his blessing after Tytle delivered the script to him personally in London. Walt felt that significant cuts needed to be made in order to make it work, which Rowe initially pushed back against, but Tytle insisted that Rowe make the changes Walt had asked for. In fact, Walt was so charmed by the idea that he felt it might warrant development as a live-action feature film. When development on the project ground to a halt the following year, Tytle suggested to Walt that the story may be better suited to animation than live-action. The Aristocats was soon slated to follow The Jungle Book as Disney's next animated feature, but with everyone firmly focused on the Rudyard Kipling adaptation, the film was placed to one side. By the time the studio turned its attention once again to the Aristocats, they were faced with a significant challenge. They knew that Walt had intended this project as their next film, but he had never had the chance to apply his trademark scrutiny to it before he had died. The animation staff at Walt Disney Productions now faced their first great challenge in the wake of Walt's death, creating a Disney animated feature without him, and with only a sketch of a map to lead the way. With the Aristocats, do you remember the first time that you would have seen this film?
I don't remember what age I would have been when we first got it. Still relatively young, but when I say relatively young, like younger than 10, but I don't remember when exactly we got it. You know, what? Unfortunately, the only thing, you know, with having so many Disney films was that, you know, it was always kind of a, yes, we get a new one, but I just watched them so many times that it kind of all blend into, you know, blend the stories together a little bit. So I don't remember watching it the first time. I do sort of remember that I've, you know, watched it multiple times and knowing the songs off by heart, even, you know, 10 years after not seeing it when I rewatched it this week. As soon as we started watching it, I like the first couple of songs I was singing along to and I'm like, I definitely have not seen this for the last 10 years, but I still remember word by word. Listening to word by word and going, what on earth have they written here?
Yes, there are a few moments in the Aristocats where, in one song in particular, where you're like, there's a line in Everybody Wants. I mean, obviously, there's the horrid, you know, Asian racist stereotype that appears in that song. But there's one line in that song that genuinely befuddled me, which is the moment where Duchess is playing on the harp and she goes, "If you want to turn me on," and I was like, this is a like everything around this is a family film. What does she mean by that? As she's salaciously playing the harp while all of the male cats stare at it. If you want to turn me on, I was like, I'm not going to forget that. I'm definitely going to need to bring that up when I talk about this film. So had it been a film that you'd revisited as you grew older, or was it that you had like revisiting for the podcast? Was it the first time you'd seen it in a while?
I probably saw it maybe my early 20s, but I don't remember seeing it since. I probably have, but we do like to put Disney on sometimes when we have been drinking.
You're not the first person on this podcast to have said that.
Rewatching it for this podcast was kind of the first time I can pinpoint when I last watched it.
First of all, as an audience member, we'll talk about, you know, as a vet nurse and as you know, a cat rescuer in a moment, but as an audience member, what was it like to revisit it?
True typical, you know, Disney styling, like the music is just very on point, even though this what they're singing is terrible, but you know, it's catchy, you know, catchy tunes that you then remember and draws you in and you find yourself singing or humming along to it, and the beautiful imaging, like the pictures that they've done, you know, how gorgeous each of the cats are right through the movie and the scenes that they've got, just, you know, visually it's beautiful to watch still, and you know, and certain little characters that you just kind of remember and, oh, loved this one and loved that one, and little comic gags that the different characters introduce that that even though there might only be one scene, you're just kind of drawn to them very quickly and laugh every time, even though they're sometimes terrible gags.
Funny you were talking before about, you know, the memory, like the sense memory you have of a film. Because this was not a film that I revisited often as a kid. I think I've maybe seen it less than 10 times in my life, full stop. And so there were certain things that I did kind of have a sense memory of, but there were other things I didn't remember at all, like Abigail and Amelia, the two geese. And I was just cackling. Like, they're fabulous. They're almost the best characters in the film. They just walk in like, you know, French and Saunders and just deliver this like very dry, wonderfully witty humor to the film and then waddle off with their drunk uncle. And you're like, oh, great. Come back. Come back. We want to see a bit more of you. And so as a vet nurse, watching the film through that lens, having not seen it for a while, what did you make of it in that sense?
Through the eyes of rescue, like, it's just like, oh my goodness, look at all these stray animals. And I actually had to go back and look and see what year the movie was supposed to be set in. You know, a privileged animal of today would be dissexed or, you know, kept indoors, definitely not allowed outside, no cat door. Those sorts of things.
So not riding on the hat of a horse either.
That too, yes. Although I do know a few people that do put little harnesses on their cats and take them out for drives in the car and things like that. So, or walks on the street. But yeah, there's just a few little things that, you know, pinpointed the movie that you're just like, ooh, the animators or the creators, these characters didn't really have a true understanding of cats.
It's funny, I hadn't really thought about this, but there's kind of a weird correlation between like the way that certain Disney films can kind of romanticize the idea of being an orphan or the idea of being like a lost child, like the lost boys in Peter Pan, for example. And there's a way that it kind of can romanticize that. This film kind of romanticizes the idea of an animal living on the street that, you know, they've always got something to eat. They can do whatever they want. They can go play jazz with their friends. It is a very like romantic, like obviously the idea of, you know, a mother cat and a bunch of kittens living in a mansion, getting whatever they want, you know, getting taken care of beautifully. Like that's a fantasy and a romanticized idea. But even the street cats are not realistic, are not like, you know, the actual plight of what it would be like to live as an animal on the street.
Okay, let's charge.
Wait a minute. I'm the leader. I'm the one that says when we go. Here we go. Charge!
In the aftermath of Walt's death, the task fell to Roy to guide the company towards whatever future lay ahead. Walt had stepped down as president in 1945 and as chairman of the board in 1960 in order to focus on the creative side of the company. In both cases, Roy had taken up Walt's role, and by 1966, he held the position of president, chief operating officer, and chairman of the board at Walt Disney Productions. Roy had always been the more business-minded of the brothers, but with Walt gone, Roy now faced the responsibility of guiding the creative aspects of the company as well. Roy's personal priority was to see Walt's plans for the Florida project completed, which he renamed Walt Disney World in honor of his brother. To assist him with film production, a committee was set up that included writer and producer Winston Hibler, director James Agler, writer Bill Walsh, and other members of the various film and television divisions. The aim of the committee was to provide guidance and support for Roy in handling film production going forward without Walt's supervision. Another member of this committee was Walt's son-in-law, Ron Miller. Ron was a native of Los Angeles and had distinguished himself at the University of Southern California as a skilled footballer. It was here that Miller met Diane Disney, Walt's eldest daughter, on a blind date after a football game. They married in 1954, and after serving in the army, Miller began a career as a professional footballer until he was knocked out unconscious during a game. At the end of that season, Walt approached Miller, telling him he was going to get himself killed playing football and that he should come and work for him instead. Miller agreed and joined Walt Disney Productions as a second assistant in 1957. By the early 1960s, Miller became a co-producer on a number of the live-action films, as well as directing some of the introductions to the weekly television show, and during the committee meetings after Walt's death, was named executive producer in charge of all film and television production. Significant restructuring also happened within the animation department. Wolfgang Reitherman was determined to honor his promise to Walt to lead the department in his absence, and of the senior staff, he seemed the best suited to the leadership position. When Walt died, remembered Ollie Johnson, we got together and voted to leave things as they were, and we'll make the decisions as best we can. Wally said, "Golly guys, I don't know whether I can do it." We said, "We'll help you." He said, "We're going to be leaning against each other to stand up. Any one of us by ourselves would fall down. Let's try and see if it works." Here's Wolfgang Reitherman.
There was no replacement for a wall. And in my view, the main thing was to keep this team together and keep the same creative juices flowing that they had with Walt.
It was decided that the best way forward was to establish a centralized team, a majority of whom were working effectively on the still-to-be-completed The Jungle Book. Reitherman would be the director and producer, with Ken Anderson, Larry Clemens, and Mel Shaw in charge of story and character, Dog Griffith in charge of layout, and Frank Thomas, Ollie Johnson, Milt Call, Eric Larson, and John Lounsbury in charge of animation. Fortunately, the real giants of animation were willing to pull together, remembered Reitherman. You had to respect and listen to everyone because we were all equals, and try and make decisions when they occur without getting all involved. You can spend more time and more money vacillating than if you decide on one thing and do it as well as you can. And I think that approach was very, very fruitful.
I always had little meetings so that those animators who were the key to producing any picture, so that those guys were in on the decisions. And it wasn't a fearless leader type of thing by any means. And you got an awful lot of good input. And when it finally got a little solidified, they felt they were part of the creative process instead of dumping it out there and saying, look, do it.
Their first task was to assess the work done so far on the Aristocats. Reitherman had been made aware of the project after Harry Teitel had suggested to Walt that it might work as an animated film, and Reitherman had expressed enthusiasm for it as a follow-up to The Jungle Book. In 1966, Walt tasked Ken Anderson and writer Otto Englander to work out whether the Aristocats would be feasible as an animated film. Looking over the treatment by McGowan and Rowe, they decided to simplify the two storylines and shift the focus from the human characters to the cats. In the meantime, Walt brought on the Sherman Brothers to compose songs for the film. With the focus on the challenges posed by The Jungle Book, work on the Aristocats progressed slowly, with Walt approving of the work being done by Anderson and Englander. By this point, Harry Teitel had moved on from the project, his focus on live-action projects rather than animation. This was the state of affairs when Reitherman called the first story meeting for the film on December 28, 1966, a few weeks after Walt's death. In attendance at this meeting were Reitherman, Ken Anderson, story artists Don DeGrady and Vance Gerry, writer Larry Clements, animator Dick Lucas, and executives Bill Anderson, Winston Hibbler, and Bill Walsh. It was decided that the story was too long and too complicated, and would need to be simplified before production could begin. My first question relating directly to the film was that there's such a strong family unit with Duchess and the three kittens. And I just was kind of wondering, how much does that reflect on actual cat family relationships? Like, what kind of relationship does a mother cat or a parental cat have with their kittens? How much is the film making up? But also, is there any aspect of that the film is accurate about?
So a mother cat will look after her kittens up until sort of around the 8 to 12 week stage. Usually by that stage, she's pregnant again. if she's not de-sexed, once the kittens get to around that 12 week stage, they've usually got siblings on the way. So at 12 to 16 weeks, a kitten will usually get a bit of a need to sort of start wandering. And that's instinctual, like that they got to the age that they need to wander off and find their own homes. Because in the wild, female cats will actually live by themselves in a territory, and they'll chase away any other cats that come into this territory unless they're in season. So unless they're ready for a male cat to come in, at which stage they put on a dance and show about, oh, boys, I'm over here. Come on, you can come in now. I won't attack you and drive you off. So unless there's a huge amount of resources, cats don't tend to live in groups. We see it a bit more in cities because they do tend to be, large. We get colonies forming because as humans we leave food in, rubbish bins and tips, or we put food out for them. So we attract them to come and live in colonies. But normally a female cat actually out in the wild would be living in her own little territory, and she cares for her kittens up to a certain point. And then once they get old enough, she goes, okay, well, time for you to wander off now. And cats actually can start breeding from 4 months of age. So they've sort of only got that couple of weeks of wandering away from their mum before they can start becoming parents themselves. So, yeah, that part of the film, well, yes, you know, we've got that little tight family unit to begin with, but we're certainly not as kittens looking for a father figure generally. The male cats tend to come in, do the job and leave again.
And how protective are mother cats of the kittens at an early stage, at the early stages of their life, before they kind of get to an age where they can go off on their own? How protective? Because Duchess is a very protective parent to her children. Yeah, how protective are mother cats to their kittens when they're newly born and they're just growing?
Every cat's different, same with every human's different in their level of parenting, but they tend to be, yeah, quite protective, and they'll try and, you know, if they get any sense that, especially as their kittens are very small, any sense that where the kittens are is a danger, so someone comes and finds them, or the area is very high traffic, so if someone's, you know, as a human, we're walking past the area all the time, checking in on them, you'll tend to find the mum cats will pick them up and move the kittens to somewhere a bit quieter, hidden, you know, back of a cupboard, underneath the table, somewhere that's a bit more protected and quiet for the kittens. So they can be really protective of them, and especially against other animals coming in as well. I've watched a female cat chase an adult cat that she'd never seen before but could smell him on the other side of the door. When the door opened, she chased him across the house and attacked him. And this cat was bigger than her too. So they can be very protective of their offspring when the kittens are little.
That kind of leads to my next question, which was, you know, there's so much about in the film about the relationship between animals. Obviously, there's, you know, unrealistic relationships like, you know, having a good relationship with Roquefort the mouse and stuff like that. But to what, how social are cats generally? Like, if, you know, obviously, with being quite territorial, they're quite protective, but is there a capacity for them to be social? Or is it just that everything we're seeing on Instagram of cats loving each other just entirely made up and manufactured, like the film?
Male cats actually have a very high, you know, they tend to live as groups. The boys are off, you know, wandering around living the bachelor life until they find a female. So they're actually much more happy to settle into a group situation, especially when you introduce a new cat to your household. The boys tend to relax and chill out a bit easier than the girls. Female cats tend to be, unless you've brought them in together as young cats, they tend to not appreciate you bringing new ones into the house. They can get quite upset about it. It takes them a lot longer to adapt to living as a group. And sometimes you're trying to introduce a new cat to the household and you just, they'll just never get along. Whereabouts others, you know, if you've got time and patience and do the introductions properly, they'll figure out how to interact with each other. And cats, when they are living together, actually do form hierarchies. So, you know, in dogs we have the hierarchy of the pack. In cats we actually do too. It's just a little bit more harder to see sometimes who the actual boss of the group is, because their behaviours towards one another when they're dominating one another is a little bit different to dogs. And even sometimes we get phone calls that, you know, people that have adopted these cats and cats are doing these strange behaviours to the owners and they're like, oh, you know, what's this? And they're doing this and I'm really worried. And it's like, oh, yep, that's just the cat dominating you and decide that it's top of the food chain.
Yes. So, yes, there are definitely moments where my cat Dexter, I'm kind of looking at him like, you're trying to assert dominance over me. That's not going to work, buddy.
And the funny thing is a lot of humans actually do let their cats get away with asserting the dominance over them and then they start getting problems in the house. Cats can, you know, often come together and live as a group, especially if you're introducing them together when they're young or introducing a kitten to the household rather than another adult cat. But by all means, they can, yeah, form these relationships with one another. And cats can even form relationships with other species as well. We have a lot of cats that are brought up around dogs so that they know how to interact around the dogs. Or, you know, if a puppy is introduced to a household with a cat, the cat will tend to tell the dog how it's going to be. I have rabbits in our house that actually live in our house, not in a cage. They hop around the house. And the rabbits are the boss of the cats.
Really?
It's quite hilarious watching them sometimes put them in their place. And these are prey species. So,
yeah, I was going to say, that's not usually the way that the animal kingdom works. Rabbits are not usually the top of any hierarchy.
And even, you know, the relationship with the mouse in the movie being very good friends and eating from the bowl. Well, if you Google it on, you know, the internet, you'll find videos and pictures of cats eating and mice running across and starting to eat from the bowl. So these cats that obviously are very well fed and don't have to think about hunting.
I was genuinely not expecting that like of the behavioral aspects of the animals in the Aristocats, that sense of community and camaraderie isn't a completely ridiculous idea. I mean, you know, particularly the idea of, you know, O'Malley having this gang of alley cats that he lives with, interacts with, shares experiences with, that they can kind of form that community together. Now, as someone who spends a lot of time with cats, what do you make of the way that the cat's behavior is depicted in the film? Like, in the, like the way that the cats move, the way the cats play with each other, the way that they, you know, the way that the animators have approached the anatomy and behavioral traits of cats and kittens, how much do they get right?
Anatomy-wise and the movements, they've done a really great job. Cats are very fluid-like and very good at bending and jumping and, you know, making those jumps and landing when we don't think they will. And as much as you can put them onto paper, the animes have just done a fantastic job.
There's one moment that really sticks out in particular, which is when O'Malley is singing to Duchess the first time that he meets her, and she's to feign lack of interest, she starts cleaning herself. And, you know, like, you know, I'll sit there and watch my cat Dexter clean himself all the time because it's just so fascinating to watch the process. And that process is so accurate in terms of the way, not only the way that Duchess is going about cleaning herself, but the behavioral reasons for doing it, of, you know, trying to feign disinterest or trying to relax herself or, you know, trying to calm herself down in a situation. That was something that really struck me rewatching it today. I was like, that's very close to what I would imagine a cat doing.
Definitely. And grooming is actually one of these things that, like, they don't just do it to keep themselves clean, but as you mentioned, they do it because they're stressed out and they want to try and calm themselves, or they don't know how to deal with the situation. So they do something that they know, and, you know, they know that will bring them back into the center of their mind. And dogs do it a little bit as well. They tend to develop these little over-grooming of their feet because they know that previously they've groomed their feet and it felt good. So they're not feeling so well. They're stressed by situations. So they'll groom their feet to try and bring back that, you know, good feeling again. So also that dominating, trying to assert their, you know, where they are in the situation and their hierarchy. Grooming also comes into that as well, with, you know, a cat grooming another cat, not because it sees the other cat as the boss, but because it wants to dominate that it is the boss. So, yeah, it's grooming is definitely a big, big part of natural behaviour. And, yeah, the way that Duchess, you said, just did it just at the right time, where she's just fanning this disinterest and doing something else at the time to also show that she's got that disinterest as well, is, yeah, very well done.
It's a really lovely aspect, and similar to I guess Lady and the Tramp, of the astute observations the animators have made around, like, they're not just drawing a basic cat and having it act like a human. It's very clear these are definitely cats. These aren't anthropomorphized, certainly not to the extent that you would see in a film like Robin Hood, which is animals in a fully anthropomorphized depiction. They're still very much cats. They might talk, they might sing, they might have slight behavioural differences, but they move and feel exactly like the animals that we're familiar with. Another moment that I wanted to ask about in terms of cat behaviour is, you know, the stars of the film, really, which is the three kittens, you know, Marie, Berlioz and Toulouse. There's that moment before the music lesson, which is, you know, the most beautiful scene in the film, when they're, you know, when they're seeing scales and arpeggios together. But there's, as they're going to prepare to do it, there's that kind of tumble, play acting, scratching, biting that they do. That seems to be such an important part of play for kittens, that kind of fighting quality. Why are kittens drawn to, like, that play fighting with each other?
So it's very similar with small children, and, you know, working out what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, and what level of, you know, what level of biting is okay and what actually hurts and isn't okay. And so they do it with one another, and they're learning that the social norms and the social okays, which is why it's really important for kittens to grow up in a group situation. Same with any species, like puppies as well. If they're not growing up together, they don't learn what's an okay level of biting, what's an okay level of play fighting, when you know, when's too much. Yeah, as soon as you started saying, you know, about this scene, I was like, yeah, I know exactly which one you're talking about. Yeah, so that was very, very common sort of kitten behaviour and interactions with one another.
Which is glorious to see. Like, it's why that sequence in particular really sticks out to me. I'm not the biggest fan of the Aristocats, and there are some things about the storytelling I find a little disappointing and a little bit inadequate. But that whole sequence around them doing the music lesson, where you see the behavior with each other, you see the relationship they have with one another, and the way that the song and the music lesson clearly depicts each of their three very distinct personalities, is so glorious to watch. And the fact that it's a very delicate balance between, you know, human characteristics that we need in order to be able to connect with these characters, these animated drawings on a screen, but also aspects that make us remember that these are based on animals within our own world, and the things that we fall in love with, the beautiful kids' voices and the behaviors that we associate with young children, but we also fall in love with the behaviors we associate with young kittens, which are equally rambunctious and innocent and playful and beautiful. And I mean, you know, Duchess, I guess, then is completely wrong when she's like, it's not ladylike or gentlemanly-like to, you know, bite and scratch and play. She's a moment of bad mothering for a moment from Duchess.
I was going to say female cats can be more vicious than males sometimes. So
yes. Are there any other moments in the film in terms of cat behavior or cat interactions that stuck out for you, that you were kind of, you know, moments where you went, that really hits the mark in a really unexpected way, or moments where you were like, that really doesn't, that really is completely misinterprets the way a cat would behave or the way a cat would respond to something?
Well, the scene where O'Malley introduces her to his pad and his scat cats, very unrealistic, because in that situation, cats recognize one another by smell. And when a new cat comes into an area, if they don't smell the same, they then get very hissy and growly and, you know, what are you doing here? This is not where you should be, and chasing them away. So, you know, a stray female cat and kittens wandering into someone else's territory environment, they wouldn't have been as welcoming and, you know, welcomed with a music number. Although it is kind of hinted, as you sort of mentioned, where she says, you know, if you want me to turn me on, that she probably is coming into season in there and, hello, boys.
It is a very dangerous move on O'Malley's part to be like, I've met this gorgeous cat that I definitely have a thing for. I'm going to bring her in and have her hang out with all my male friends. It's the animal kingdom. He understands the way that this all works. It is a very strange. And also, I guess that's overanalyzing the film to a certain degree of, you know, you're bringing Duchess and the kittens into a dangerous situation because you don't know how the other cats are going to react. You don't know how they're going to react to the presence of an adult female cat, but also a bunch of kittens that, as you say, don't belong to their pack, don't belong to their family group. I mean, you know, thank God they, you know, pop on some hats and pull out a trombone and a piano and sing them a song. It's funny, for a song that is as catchy as that song is, that sequence never sticks in my mind when I revisit that film. There's something that just feels very wedged in about it, that it's kind of like you've followed this very particular journey, like the journey that, you know, O'Malley meeting Duchess and the kittens and trying to get them back to Paris and, you know, meeting Amelia and Abigail, and all of that, like, kind of logically leads on from one thing to the next. And there's that episodic structure that Disney films have. That's where it's working. That scene feels a little unnecessary. And I guess maybe it's partly to do with it's narratively unnecessary, but also it's just kind of behaviorally unusual that, you know, that doesn't feel true to the relationship between these cats, the relationship the cats would have with one another, and also just doesn't serve the film in any particular way, other than maybe bringing them back at the end. Yeah, it's funny, for a song that is as iconic as that song has become, and a song that really represents that film, it's surprising how unimpactful it actually is in the film itself, and how much it kind of doesn't have anything to do with anything.
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, definitely it's that just filler to introduce the pack to, you know, come to the aid at the end. But again, not totally realistic in that either. But I think just additional characters that didn't probably need to be there, as, you know, as awesome as some of those characters are. But yeah.
Yeah, we should have just brought back Abigail and Amelia. Should have more of them.
I'm ready, my straw. Mama, he did it again.
There, there. Now, Berlioz, now please, darling, settle down and play me your pretty little song.
Yes, Mama.
As work on The Jungle Book began to wind down, the same team transitioned to the Aristocats, including writer Larry Clemens, composer George Bruns, and actors Phil Harris and Sterling Holloway. And in an effort to avoid the confusion they had experienced on the previous film, the Aristocats would be meticulously planned in pre-production to save on time and resources. On the Aristocats, remembered Ollie Johnson, none of us had been in any meetings with Walt. Ken Anderson had been in one and had made several drawings, but the rest of us didn't know what Walt had seen in the picture or what he wanted. And yet, it was designated as the next picture.
Walt was only in a first general meeting talking about how we developed this. And he talked mostly about this, the alley cat. For me. Which I named O'Malley because he was red and he had that carefree man of the world, or cat of the world, actually. Then Walt was very ill and terminally ill. And so we just had to develop the story on our own.
We'd always made the pictures the way he wanted, and we always respected the way he wanted. People seldom felt it necessary to argue with him that he didn't know what he was talking about. He always knew what he was talking about. He had a definite idea of how he wanted to make the picture. So there we were stuck without that. We were sort of, how are we going to do it?
On April 10th, 1967, a new draft of the script for The Aristocats was delivered, refashioned and simplified by Clemens from the original treatment. The character of the maid was removed, and the focus shifted to the mother cat, now named Duchess, and her three kittens, now on a journey home, rather than to find new homes for each of them. Ken Anderson had done preliminary work on the project under Walt's guidance, and now began to lead the look of the environments and characters. As he had with previous films, Anderson went as far as to animate a test sequence for the film, here involving Edgar getting caught in a wheelchair and falling into the Seine, as a way of testing out the look, feel, and rhythm of the film. In all, Anderson would spend 18 months developing the film. In order to translate the story to film, he later recalled, I had to study Parisian architecture and style. I did a lot of research and went to the library and had stuff brought in. I thought Paris was a rich feeling, and so I tried everything I could to make it appear to be that, including the characters, who were very Frenchy. The three kittens were given distinct personalities, associated with the famous French figures after which they were named. Marie was the most fashionable, named after French monarch Marie Antoinette. Berlioz, the most musically inclined, was named after French romantic composer Hector Berlioz. And Toulouse, the artist of the trio, was named after legendary French artist Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec. As well as his studies of real kittens and these historical personality traits, Ollie Johnson imbued them with the temperaments of young children. All of this work would be cemented in perhaps the finest scene in the film, the music lesson where they sing the Sherman song Scales and Arpeggios, each kitten given the chance to shine with their particular talents. Johnson also studied real geese for the scene-stealing gaggle sisters Abigail and Amelia. He visited a farm owned by a friend and observed geese in action, in particular, two who stayed close together and were highly suspicious of his presence. From these observations, the wonderfully haughty personalities of the sisters began to develop, another highlight of the film. For the animators and story artists, the secondary characters offered a solution to the flimsy narrative, holding the episodic sections together, and in the case of the farm dogs Lafayette and Napoleon, additional possibilities for action and comedy. Their first scene was so successful that additional scenes featuring the pair were added. As Johnson and Frank Thomas later observed, often we found that some clumsy story point could be told in a fresh and interesting way simply by telling it through these new personalities. The responsibility of the human characters fell to Milt Kahl, who imbued them with his freewheeling, energetic style. Rather than using live-action reference, he chose to animate Madame, Edgar, and lawyer Georges Harcourt without using reference footage, arguing that a top animator should know how humans and animals moved based on their previous work and training. Even so, ink and paint artist Grace Gaudino was asked to provide reference footage for Madame dancing with Georges, under Reitherman's direction. They took the dance sequence with me dancing in Victorian clothes, she later recalled, and they brought in a real cat, and then the cat wouldn't sit still long enough, so we got an artificial cat for me to pet, and they got such a kick out of that. By the time the film entered production, the Sherman brothers had composed a suite of songs, including the French-infused title song performed by legendary singer Maurice Chevalier.
We had many, many lovely experiences working at Disney Studios, but I think one of the funniest was when the time came to do the title song for the Aristocats, Willie Reitherman said, which singer, who do you want to be doing this title song? And Bob and I looked at each other and said, well, who else?
Chevalier.
It had to be Maurice Chevalier because he was Mr. Paris.
But he was retired.
So we, instead of sending him just a lead sheet and a song, we decided to do it with a, I would put on a little Maurice Chevalier act. I would sound like him so he'd feel comfortable with the number. So with a great deal of trepidation, I went ahead and did my Maurice Chevalier imitation. And I'll do that first, then you get the idea. Which pet's address is the finest in Paris? Which pets possess the finest pedigree? To which pets do the others tip their hats? Naturally, the aristocrats. Now, this was my Maurice Chevalier interpretation. I did the whole song that way, and we sent it to him. Well, he wrote back a lovely note saying, in deference to Sherman Brothers, they're lovely gentlemen, and I loved Walt Disney. I like to do this for him. So he came out of retirement, and we're proud to say he did his last performance was The Aristocats, and it was a delightful recording. And we happened to be in Paris, and we spoke to him shortly after that recording, and we said, Monsieur Chevalier, you must excuse us for taking the liberty of sending you that demo with the thick French accent. I mean, that interpretation. No, I just wanted to show you how it would go. And he said, accent? I heard no accent.
The Shermans were also courting Louis Armstrong for the song Le Jazz Hot, which would have been sung by Satchmo Cat, named after Armstrong, and the other Alley Cats. Armstrong was enthusiastic about the idea, but ill health ultimately forced him to decline. This song and many others were composed by the Shermans for the film, but to their surprise, all but the title song and scales and arpeggios were replaced. Le Jazz Hot was substituted for Everybody Wants to Be a Cat by Floyd Huddleston and Al Rinkler, now performed by Scatman Crothers, and their introductory song for O'Malley, My Way's the Highway, was replaced with Thomas O'Malley Cat by Terry Gilkison. This may have been due to the success of The Jungle Book, the jazz-infused score favoured over the musical hall quality of the Sherman songs. And certainly Thomas O'Malley Cat seems to be an opportunity to reunite Gilkison and Phil Harris after their enormous success with The Bare Necessities. Whatever the reason, this experience further exacerbated the relationship between the Sherman brothers and Walt Disney Productions. In the wake of Walt's death, the attitude towards the two songwriters at the studio had started to turn hostile. And they were disappointed with changes in the culture at the Burbank lot. With their work on The Aristocats and the live-action musical Bedknobs and Broomsticks completed, Richard and Robert Sherman left Walt Disney Productions to work on Albert R. Broccoli's lavish musical Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. It would be many decades before they would return. So the kind of conflict of the film rests on Edgar's decision to get rid of the cats. It's not the greatest conflict to introduce into the film, mostly just because it comes out of nowhere. Edgar doesn't seem to be have a particular problem with the cats at the beginning, before he finds out about the will, and then all of a sudden just snaps to, oh, well, the easiest thing for me to do is just to get rid of them to get what I want. This is a complicated and not particularly nice question, but that level of disregard that Edgar has for the welfare of these kittens and this cat, how much do you see that working in Cat Rescue? That idea that people are just, that can flippantly deal in the life and death of a cat? Because it always seems like cats always get, like more so than dogs, get the short end of the stick with this. How frequently does that happen? And why do you think that is, that people, you know, can have such a flippant relationship with the life and death of a cat?
Unfortunately, cats are still highly undervalued in our society, and it's very easy to get a cat. They breed, unfortunately, very, very well and very easily. And I still hear all these stories of, you know, people coming into the clinic and going, oh, my, you know, daughter came home from school with a kitten that someone else was handing around. And, you know, people come and inquire about our kittens and then find out there's an adoption fee and go, oh, no, I can get a cat for free from somewhere else, even though ours are already, you know, de-sexed, vaccinated, microchipped, had medical work. Or, you know, they come into the clinic and you say, oh, yes, they need these things. And they're like, oh, no, the cat didn't cost me anything. And now you're saying it's going to be, you know, $200, $300, $400 to get this work done. So unfortunately, there is still a large portion of humans out there that don't see cats in that, you know, special loving way that, you know, Duchess and her kitten's owner did see them. There's still huge numbers of cats that, you know, go missing and end up in pounds and shelters that don't get reclaimed. And by reclaimed, the owner coming forward and saying, yes, that's my cat, and taking it home. I think last year, so last financial year, the RSPCA's numbers showed that only about 5.5% of cats that went in were being reclaimed.
Oh, my God. That's absurdly low.
Yes. And then about over 20% of cats going in were being euthanized. So it's still these huge numbers of cats that aren't being valued enough by their owners to go out and find them and, you know, get them back and do what they need to do to make sure their cats can come home again.
It's almost a thing of, well, if it's gone, it's gone. Oh, well, not the way that you, like, if it was a dog, you would kind of, we might be inclined to kind of go the extra mile to try and find them. But with a cat, it's like, oh, well, we're never going to find that. Move on. Does that seem to be a bit of the attitude?
Yeah. Oh, they'll come home if they want to come home. And, you know, unfortunately, yes, it is. You know, cats can wander a little bit further than dogs, and, you know, cats are a little bit harder to catch than dogs. Yeah, just that, oh, well, I can just get another one easily tends to be a thing. And quite often we'll have, you know, cats that are handed in 6 or 12 months later that have been hanging out at, you know, someone's house 2 or 3 blocks down, being fed there. And these people are just nice enough to think, oh, I'll give the cat some food, it's hungry, but didn't consider that maybe they should pick the cat up and take it into a vet clinic or get the local council to scan it for its microchip and find out where it's come from. And, you know, by the time that somebody does think to do that, it's been these 6, 12 months. I've even had a cat that had been missing for 2 years that when we called the owner, they were just like, oh, you know, we just kind of assumed it died and we got a new one. People are replacing their missing cats very quickly compared to a dog owner. Well, obviously dogs are a little bit harder to get, you know, you need to go and find a breeder or go to a pound or a shelter and adopt them out, or a rescue group. Cats, unfortunately, there's people that still just find kittens on the street, or people who just let their cats breed willy-nilly and, yeah, then just giving them away on social media. So it is very easy to get a cat.
Within the community that Maneki Neko works in, what portion of the cats that end up being lost or end up being discarded, what portion generally ends up coming to you? How many of those cats end up coming through your doors?
So it can be a huge number. We primarily take from pounds and shelters. So majority, probably a good 80 to 90% of our cats and kittens are coming from pounds and shelters. The rest come to us as surrenders from owners who can't look after them anymore but don't want to risk them going to a pound or a shelter. Because unfortunately, yeah, that euthanasia rate's still so high in these places. So yeah, the majority of the ones that we take on are these ones that have gone in and not being claimed for whatever reason. And quite often it's because the owners haven't done something as simple as get them microchipped. It's now illegal for a cat or a dog to change owners without them being microchipped, or for you to sell or give away a kitten without it being microchipped. But we still get huge numbers of cats and kittens coming in that aren't microchipped.
And is that a case of they've just been, kids been handed one at school because another family's, their cats have had babies, or just like the non-traditional ways of acquiring cat? Is that usually just the reason why they don't end up having a microchip?
Yeah, and not being responsible. So they've taken ownership of this animal, but because they haven't paid for it, or we get ones that still, you know, cats that wander up onto the doorstep and decide, oh, you guys are lovely, I'll stay here. The cat choosing the owner. And we've all done it. Like, my family had a few over the years that wandered in from across the paddock and decided that they liked us and stayed. Because they've kind of wandered up, people still have in their mind that this isn't my cat, I don't own it. I feed it and I give it my attention and it gives me love, but I don't own it. Whereabouts, if a dog did that, they would be able, you know, very quickly make themselves the owner if they could. So, yeah, it's just that mindset that unfortunately a lot of people in our community still see cats as that, you know.
Like a transitional pet.
Yeah.
In some ways, there's a lack of permanence with having, like, some perceptive of a lack of permanence of having a cat. That said, if someone tried to take my cat away from them, I'd fucking lose it. I would like, I'd probably go full mother cat and start scratching and biting and making an absolute mess of myself. Which I guess leads me to kind of my next question and kind of one of my final questions in talking about the Aristocats. Yes, the conflict of the film is based on a disregard of these cats' welfare, but the whole kind of premise of the film is based on someone who has tremendous investment in the welfare and safety of her cats. What is it about cats that, like, we have, that for those of us who do have such a strong bond for them, what is it about that bond? Like, where does that bond come from? And how is that reciprocated in cats? It's often we think of cats as being very aloof animals, like a dog shows its emotions on its face, which is one of the most beautiful aspects of dogs. But cats are much harder to read. And there is often a sense sometimes that you're like, you know, is the cat living with me or am I living with the cat? Why is it that we're drawn, those of us who love cats so much are drawn to cats? And what is the relationship with them to us, back, you know, back to us?
I think because a cat has such a, again, it's a range of emotions, so their personality tends to be a lot bigger than, say, dogs, because they can experience all these different emotions, and our personalities come from the way that we see and interact with the world. And so while they might be aloof to begin with, or aloof to, you know, people they don't know, when they do choose to be your friend, you know, you build this relationship with them. And every relationship with a cat's slightly different. Like, you don't have the same relationship with two cats the way you might have the same relationship with two dogs. And because they can pick up on our emotions a lot better than, you know, other animals can. Like, other animals can quite often know that something's not right, that you are upset about something, but they don't often know why you're not upset about, like, sorry, why you're upset about something. Cats are a lot more intuitive, and they can actually pick up on what your emotions are and why you might be having those emotions. So when you do form that bond with them, they can actually provide you with a lot better emotional support, or say even same level emotional support as a human can, because they sort of know what you're going through and why, and sometimes know what you need to, you know, to give, what they need to give you back to help you out with it.
That level of emotional investment is very clear in the relationship between Madame and the cats. I mean, obviously it works for, you know, it's narratively important that Duchess and the kittens care for their owner, but it feels very genuine. Like, there's a genuine symbiosis between, you know, it's not a case of, you know, they're not going to go out into the big wild world and discover a better life and go, oh, well, actually, no, this is better. It's like, no, this is where I belong. And not, Duchess continuously brings up the thing of, it's not just about our safety and not just about where we feel safe in our home, but also the welfare of our owner, like, that she's going to be upset missing us. And that's not flippantly put into, like, it's not a flippant concern that she has. It's one that she's very genuine about. That feels very true to the relationship. Certainly the relationship, you know, I have with my cat is that sense of, like, I'm here for you, but you're also here for me as well.
Cats are often, you know, sitting there waiting for you to come back. You might not know it because you don't pick up on it at the time, but I went away last weekend and my housemate was sending me pictures of the cats waiting at the door for me to come home at different times. And, you know, they'll still come into their routine and sit on the bed and wait, you know, oh, we go to bed at this time. And without them actually turning around going, yes, we're well aware what's going on, they've known when I was pregnant and known when I brought the baby home. Oh, okay, this is, you know, this is the new one in the house. Yep, that's fine. Belongs to you. We're okay with him. So, you know, they pick up on things so quickly. And I don't think we give them the credit for it either. You know, we always talk about whether you're a cat person or a dog person, and dog people generally will say that they don't like cats. Well, I think that's often a, rather than looking at, you know, what the cat's done to them to make them not like them, I think that's more of a their personality and not under, you know, not necessarily having that kind of personality that picks up on what everyone else's emotions around them are.
A cat sees you for who you are. A dog sees you, in a way, a dog sees you for who it hopes you are, but a cat sees you for who you are. There's something very piercing about when you meet a cat and they have that in that connection. Like, most of the time when you meet them, they'll just run off and hide. But then when they finally do actually connect with you, there's an intensity to that. An intensity that I, like, you know, I'm the same. I'm neither a dog nor a cat person. I think they're both wonderful. I have a cat because it's more convenient for my living circumstances. And, you know, I love him and I, you know, will have him for the rest of his life. But there is definitely a difference of when you have that connection with the dog, there's something, you know, wonderful and deeply playful and emotional to it, but a cat really kind of stares through you, has a hyper awareness of everything about you. That maybe that's something that people find very uncomfortable about them, is that it's just, you can't bullshit in front of a cat ever. They won't accept bullshit.
No. And they call you out on it very quickly as well.
We were just practicing biting and clawing.
Aristocrats do not practice biting and clawing and things like that. It's just horrible.
But someday, we might meet a tough alley cat. Meow!
No. That will do. It's time we concerned ourselves with self-improvement. Now you want to grow up to be lovely, charming ladies and gentlemen. Now to lose, you go and start on with your painting.
Yes, Mama.
In the aftermath of Walt's death, the animation department faced a greater challenge than realizing the Aristocats. There had been a constant pressure from both Roy and the board of directors to close the department, especially in the wake of Sleeping Beauty. But Walt had resisted. Instead, he routinely downsized staff sizes and budgets, forcing the artist to find creative and cost-effective ways to make feature films. With Walt gone, though, that line of defense was also gone, and Wolfgang Reitherman needed to find ways to justify their existence. An issue that weighed on Reitherman's mind was that Walt's nine old men, the core team of artists who maintained animation at Disney, were starting to live up to that title. Many of them had joined the studio as young men in the 1930s, but they had now been there for nearly 40 years. Reitherman decided that they needed a new generation of animators to train and prepare for the eventual retirement of him and his colleagues. On September 9th, 1970, while the Aristocats was in production, Reitherman began drafting Ideas and Thoughts Concerning the Future of Animation in the Disney Tradition, a document he intended to pass on to Disney executives. In it, he outlined a plan to find and train new animators by establishing an internal training program. We need to set our goals on what we can pass on to the younger generation, he wrote, without trying to squeeze them into our mold, maybe with less emphasis on our expensive and extremely well-analyzed animation. By de-emphasizing this kind of animation somewhat and fortifying the new approach with stronger personality, showmanship, and story, perhaps there is a way to go which we have always thought was impossible. I know that Walt was looking for something like this, an easier way. Reitherman's language in the document is careful and clever, acknowledging the excesses of the past and a determination for new methods in the future as a way of justifying the search for new talent. On October 23rd, he submitted the final version, sending the document to Executive Vice President Card Walker and producers Bill Anderson and Ron Miller. They immediately approved his suggestions, and within days, plans for a training program began falling into place. Ken Anderson began by launching a training program within the story department, recruiting promising artists Bob Foster, Alec Gonzalez, and Pete Young. He gave them the task of storyboarding a Don Tracy short story, The Pelican That Hated to Dive. The task of training the next generation of animators fell to Eric Larson, who was busy working on the character of Roquefort in The Aristocats. The film would be the last on which he would work as an animator, later devoting his energies almost entirely to the new training program. In the years that you've been working with Maneki Neko, I imagine you've seen hundreds of cats come through, hundreds of different very particular experiences and circumstances. What's been the most rewarding aspect of your work in Cat Rescue? What's the thing that keeps you going with it? What's the thing that you kind of hold closest to your heart in working in that area?
A lot of the work that I do directly with the cats is, so I rare bottle babies, so neonates. So these are kittens that really shouldn't be away from their mother and are really high risk of not making it if, you know, you're not putting in 24-hour care to them and paying attention to what their needs are. I also do a lot of work with, you know, very unwell cats or cats that need a lot more medical attention. So just being able to see, you know, these tiny little kittens that come into your care growing up and getting to that stage that you can then adopt them out to new homes and getting those little updates from their new owners just to see kind of what something that you've spent a lot of your time and energy not creating but you know, bringing up and rearing and supporting, seeing what a joy that they then make to, you know, their new families. And what part of, you know, household they become is just, yeah, really beautiful. And these ones that especially come in that the vets are sort of saying, I don't think they'll make it, or, you know, you're sort of looking at going, ooh, are you going to make it through the night or not? And then getting to that stage where they pull through and go on to, yeah, make a difference in someone else's life too is just, yeah, really beautiful thing.
I can imagine, as opposed to the circumstances you were talking about before of people, you know, it's very easy to get a cat, being surprised that when you adopt a rescue cat that there is a cost involved, obviously because of, you know, the amount of work that's been done to keep the cat alive and keep the cat healthy and make sure that, you know, all of the legal requirements are done. But I can imagine that if someone does turn up and they do spend the money and they do invest in the idea of adopting a rescue cat, is there a certain degree of expectation of knowing that they're probably going to somewhere where they're going to be loved and cared for and safe? As much as money shouldn't be a factor in it, do you get that sense of when a cat goes off to a new home of knowing whether, you know, that it's going to go off to somewhere safe where it's going to have a lovely, happy life?
Yeah. So we've got an adoption process where you actually need to fill in an application first when you are, you know, applying to adopt this cat. And then we have a conversation with them about the needs of this cat and what their personality is like and, you know, what your household's like and who's in your household and what your expectations are for this cat. So we want to make sure that we're matching up family with, you know, a new friend who will become part of their family that's the right fit. It's not always the case. Sometimes we don't always get it right, especially if, you know, the humans are not telling us everything or their expectations weren't quite, you know, sometimes expectations are a bit higher than you're expecting and we don't meet them. Sometimes it doesn't work out for other reasons. But we have a return policy at any time during the cat's life as well, because we want to make sure that if it doesn't work out, that they come back to us, so that we can then try and, you know, make sure the next time around it does, especially with the information that the owners are able to give us of why it didn't work out that first time as well. So, you know, we do our best to make sure that every home, we can't expect it to be the perfect home every time, but, you know, that we are sending our cats to a good home and to the best of our ability.
Well, there it is, my own penthouse pad. It's not exactly the Ritz, but it's peaceful and quiet. Oh, no. Sounds like Scat Cat and his gang have dropped by.
Oh, friends of yours?
Uh-huh, yeah, they're old buddies and they're real swingers.
Swingers? What is a swinger?
You know, not exactly your type, Duchess, and maybe we'd better find another place, huh?
Oh, no. I would like to see your pad and meet your scat cat.
Well, okay.
After 4 years in production and at the cost of $4 million, the Aristocats opened on December 11th, 1970. The critical response was warm, albeit not as rapturous as that for The Jungle Book. In the Chicago Sun-Times, Roger Ebert wrote that the film was light and pleasant and funny. The characterization is strong, and the voices of Phil Harris and Eva Gabor are charming in their absolute rightness. Charles Chamblin, reviewing for the Los Angeles Times, praised its gentle, good-natured charm, which will delight the small fry and their elders alike. Though also noted that it lacks a certain kind of vigor, boldness, and dash, a kind of hard-focused emphasis, which you would say was a Disney trademark. More importantly, the film made $10.1 million at the domestic box office, assuring the Disney board that feature animation was still a profitable venture. Overseas, The Aristocats was the most popular general release film in Britain, and was enormously popular in France, where it still ranks as the 18th most popular film of all time in terms of admissions. Though The Aristocats has become a perennial favourite, it has garnered criticism in the decade since its release. On subsequent re-releases, critics commented on its derivative plot ideas and episodic structure. "The worst one could say of The Aristocats," wrote Leonard Moulton, "is that it is unmemorable. It's smoothly executed, of course, and enjoyable, but neither its superficial story nor its characters have any resonance." More recently, there have been concerns over the garish and uncomfortable Asian stereotypes used in Everybody Wants to Be a Cat. In many ways, some of the laziest racial stereotyping in any Disney film from that period. The film now carries a warning on Disney Plus for culturally insensitive content. After the remarkable run of classic films through the 50s and 60s, The Aristocats feels insubstantial and uninspired by comparison. There are certainly moments of greatness, the music lesson, the action sequences with Edgar, Napoleon, and Lafayette around the haystack, and the gloriously funny geese Abigail and Amelia, to name a few. But ultimately, the film leaves very little of an impression. There's also a sense of trying too hard to repeat the success of The Jungle Book, with a similar structure, tone, and sound, but without the emotional weight and strong thematic arc that held that film together. In many ways, The Aristocats feels like a stepping stone, a link between the Walt era of Disney animation and the post-Walt era. It suffers ultimately without his guidance, but perhaps more so from an attempt to imagine what guidance he would have offered. Reitherman and his team had tried to imitate what Walt would have wanted, but in the end, they were only able to offer a shadow of what might have been. To finish off on one last question we ask on Ink and Paint, do you have a favourite Disney animated classic?
I do. I think it would have to be The Little Mermaid.
Ah, I think you're one of the first people to mention The Little Mermaid so far. I don't think any other guests have mentioned it. What a great choice.
Just everything about that film, just, you know, again, the beautiful imagery of it, the songs, like, it's the best songs out of any Disney movie, I feel. And I just love Ursula the villain as well, just everything about it. But I think she'd actually, funnily enough, have to be my favourite character in that movie.
Oh, she's amazing. She's the best. She's you know, she's got the best song. She has the best character design. She has the best, like, henchman. Oh, Ursula's easily the best. In a film where there's so many great characters, Ursula just steals it. It's amazing to think of, you know, the idea of an animated character walking in and stealing a film. I mean, it's pencil on paper. It's, you know, it's artificially created. But, you know, Ursula's like Maleficent or Cruella de Vil or, you know, or the genie as one of those characters that just walks in and goes, oh, you've just literally taken the film out of the hands of every other character and nobody matters as much as you do right now. And she's kind of almost the best example of that. In some ways, even more so than the genie, because she has so much less time in the film. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to digging into Ursula in particular, her legacy, where she's come from, her impact on popular culture. Yeah, she's a fabulous character. Well, Joanne, thank you so much for spending your time talking to us on Ink and Paint and sharing your experiences with cats and cat rescue and your love of the Aristocats. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much for having me.
In 1968, Roy Disney stepped down as president of Walt Disney Productions, while remaining chairman of the board and chief operating officer. Don Tatum was named president, with Card Walker appointed in the new role as executive vice president. Roy had intended to retire, but postponed these plans to ensure that work on Walt Disney World was completed. On October 1, 1971, the new park officially opened to the public, and a few months later, on December 20th, almost exactly 5 years after Walt, Roy O. Disney passed away after suffering from a stroke. Roy had never positioned himself as the public face of the company he built with Walt, allowing his more gregarious younger brother to do so, but his level-headedness and keen mind for business had helped keep the company afloat through its many tumultuous decades. Walt Disney Productions may have been a monument to Walt Disney's imagination, but it was also a monument to Roy Disney's patience, intelligence, and tremendous faith. The legacy of the Disney family now fell on the shoulders of Walt's widow, Lillian, and his daughters, Diane and Sharon, and Roy's widow, Edith, and his son, Roy Edward, who had joined the studio as an assistant director in 1951. Though the Aristocats was not as great an artistic success as the Jungle Book, its financial success had guaranteed the place of feature animation at Disney. The new talent development program had also gotten off to a terrific start, bringing in new talent from both within and outside of the studio. Among them were two young animators who would, in years to come, dramatically shift the story of Disney animation, Gary Goldman and Don Bluth. These new recruits would need something on which to cut their teeth, but Walt had left no other projects in development apart from the Aristocats. Their next project would be the first the artists at Disney would develop entirely on their own. Ken Anderson was still intrigued by the idea of a society run by animals, the kind he had been conceiving with Chanticleer. Rather than resurrecting that troubled project, he looked to other classic stories that might work better. The first animated film fully developed after the death of Walt Disney would be a surprising departure for Disney animation in many ways, a melting pot of new ideas, new voices, and an entirely new tone. They were headed to Sherwood Forest, and the classic story of a beloved folk hero stealing from the rich to give to the poor. A collision of the traditions of Disney animation, the emerging voice of independent American cinema, and the growing political turmoil threatening to tear the country apart. On the next episode of Ink and Paint.
In the words of Anna Kendrick, they draw them really sexy. It's like they do somehow manage to create the sense of him. You sort of forget he's a fox at times.
I'm joined by theatre maker Elizabeth Brennan to look at the rambunctious classic Robin Hood. Thanks again to Joanne Amos for joining me on this episode. You can find out more about Maneki Neko Cat Rescue at neko.org.au. and on Instagram at Maneki Neko Cat Rescue. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the making of the Aristocats, including concept art and animation sketches, and information about the history of the film on home video. You can follow Ink and Paint on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at InkPaintPod for bonus material and news on upcoming episodes. You can also email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au and find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. A big thank you to all our listeners supporting us on Patreon. If you'd like to support the podcast and have access to exclusive bonus content, be sure to check out our Patreon at patreon.com/inkpaintpod. We release new episodes every fortnight, as well as bonus in-betweeners every now and then. So if you enjoyed the show, please rate, review, and follow on your favourite podcasting platform. And don't forget to tell your friends. Ink and Paint was created, hosted, and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Theme music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Piranakis, with episode illustrations by Lily Grace Meek, and the podcast is released through Switch, maketheswitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.
You know, can you hear that?
I can speaking of cats asserting dominance.
That would be one of my cats not asking for consent. Oh dear, yes. We have the hierarchy sometimes being.
Well, they are welcome guests on this episode. Absolutely.